Some were able to stay open. A lot of the smaller ones, I mean, many were shut down for certain, but the ones that did stay open, half, if not three-fourths of the payroll was covered by the government. But then being the only guest, when I got to that bungalow, there were probably eight of us out of 30, 40 rooms. And then very quickly, it was five, then three. And there were other hotels that I went to later on that I stayed at, the same situation, like this one beautiful villa that normally would be $600 a night for their basic room. It was $45 at that point.
Welcome to Travel Stories with your hosts, Tom Kim and Trevor Mountcastle. This episode, we delve 5 years into the past. We look at the start of the pandemic, and we have a very, very special guest with us today, Chris, long a friend of both Tom and I, and hopefully now a friend of the podcast. Welcome.
Hello.
Welcome, welcome.
So Chris, we wanted to have you on the podcast because you've done a couple of incredible things. Okay, more than a couple, but at least two incredible things that we wanted to kind of talk about and share with our listeners on this episode. Just for our listeners' sake, we're recording this a little bit before the 5 year anniversary of the COVID lockdown. We wanted to do this episode. You know, 5 years has kind of been enough, so we don't think it's too soon. But there are some interesting stories that I think came out of COVID and that lockdown, and Chris has a really interesting one. So to summarize, I guess for you, you made decisions and you really made life-changing decisions leading up to that pandemic. Talk us through that.
Well, it was a little bit of lucky foresight. I'd actually been in Australia, and when COVID hit over in China, I started hearing about it, and then a little bit more in the U.S. And when I came back to the U.S., I actually went to San Diego. And if you remember how it hit New York first and then quickly went to the West Coast, but most of the rest of the country had a couple of days, a week and a half before lockdown started. But I had seen what the lockdown had done in California. I was staying at a Hilton and walking around. There was nobody at the hotel. All the food was takeaway. So there wasn't quarantine or anything. But I go back home. And a few days later, I'm supposed to go to Joburg for a site visit. So I'm literally driving to the airport. My boss calls me, and I'm about to get on an airplane to Johannesburg. And he says, don't get on the airplane. The university is shutting down. And I was like, oh, we're going through this now. And I was like, it's not fun over in California. You know, we're going to be stuck 2, 3, 4 weeks like that. Let's go somewhere. So I picked up, went back, changed out bags, drove down to Chicago, turned in some Alaska miles for JAL first, and eventually made my way to Bangkok. It was supposed to be toward Indonesia, got the visa situation literally while I was flying over the Pacific changed. And when I landed in Tokyo for the connection, the visa requirements had already been updated. So then I had to pivot, and I was like, hey, can you get me? I just looked at the flight board and was like, where can I go now? And I was like, can you get me to Bangkok instead of Bali? And the next thing I know, I'm heading toward Bangkok.
So let's dive into that a little bit here. So you make it to Chicago. We already know that things are starting to shut down. Options are starting to become more and more limited. You know that you've got that Japan Airlines first class. You're at the airport. What's the vibe?
It was rough. I walked out and I have pictures of the Chicago, the international terminal, or it's not the international terminal now, but of the JAL where the drop-off area is, no cars. There was one truck, maintenance truck parked out there, but I literally took several pictures sitting in the middle of this 6-8 lane drop-off area with no cars. Going to the airport, surprisingly, the flagship lounge was supposed to be closed that day, but they forgot to communicate to the employees. So all the employees show up and they're like, oh, you're not supposed to be here. It's like, well, we're here. So they stayed open one more day. And this was like I think March 21. I need to go back and look at that exact date.
So that's pretty significantly into it, kind of like the really the beginnings of all of this.
And yeah. So no quarantines yet.
Right.
Quarantines
right.
are coming in a day or two, and no travel restrictions so much at that point. So
you really kind of squeaked in, like right at the right as things were locking down. You kind of were right almost at that border or that edge.
You're like rolling under the door as the blast door is closing.
Yeah. And speaking of the door that's closing too, when I checked in at JAL, they said I couldn't get on because they were reading the quarantine restrictions that had yet to go into effect, which were going into effect in 48 hours. So I can't remember the terminology, but I'd already been Googling everything. And I was like, no, read this. And it took about an hour to get me checked in to be allowed actually into the restrictions into the country you're entering. Japan wasn't an issue at that point. But even at that time, going back to the trivia you asked about the vibe, I mean, the American gate agents and lounge people were having huddles of like 30 people at a time. They didn't know what was going on. Supervisors didn't know what was going on. There were people crying because they knew their jobs were ending or at least at somehow stake, being
you know, affected. They were impacted, right?
Yeah. And it was a very somber moment.
Can I ask the question that I'm sure some people are thinking, like, this didn't bother you? Like, you made the decision. I'm going. I'm not wasting this opportunity. I got the ticket. I'm going to Asia. Like, did you have any concerns at this time? Like, were you like thinking about like, oh, am I doing the right thing here? Like what was going through your head out of curiosity?
I wasn't certain. The only thing that I didn't really think through, because we all thought it was going to be a month, a few, you know, a couple of weeks, a month. I mean, there wasn't, and I was just like, and I'd already actually planned to take vacation after my Joburg trip. So it was in that, and the question was, after seeing what happened in California to where it wasn't fun, I was like, okay, do I want to stay in my house where I'm living, or do I want to go to a beach?
It was a calculated decision. And you were absolutely kind of weighing the information available to, at the time. And this is great because sometimes I forget about, because, you know, I didn't have any active travel in March, but I do remember, you know, some of what was going on around that time. And it's a good reminder that, you know, when we go back in the time machine back to March of, what was that, 2020, many people were like, oh, this is going to be like, oh, yeah, there might be a short quarantine. That we didn't know at the time what was about to happen, right? Like, this was still early on, and people had very different thoughts about what the world was going to look like for the next 30, 90 days than what we ultimately understood it to be later that year, right?
Yeah, there was no information at that point. Things were changing so quickly, nobody knew.
But there were indications. I mean, we did see what China was doing in Wuhan. We knew the severity of it. I mean, I think at one point they had clearly had lockdowns in Wuhan and in other places in Asia. I mean, I think we clearly had indications of the severity, just not how long this was going to be. Walk us through that experience. You're landing in Japan. Now, you said that you had changed your flight en route or when you had landed.
Yeah. When I got to Tokyo, I wasn't allowed into Bali. So could not go to Indonesia because they had changed their travel restrictions, entry restrictions at that point in time. So then I had to pivot and say, okay, where could I go? Wound up being allowed into Thailand. And Tom, you had asked about, you know, the door. There was a physical door. So I had the option to actually transfer to, like I said, I turned in JAL miles for F. Wound up flying the business class connection because of the plane, but there was an option to leave 6 hours later out of Haneda. I flew into Narita that, and then the Haneda plane had first. And they're like, oh, do you want to take that? And I was like, I think I just want to get someplace. I think that's more important now. So it took a fairly quick connection, didn't transfer. But when I landed in Thailand, in Bangkok, it was about 11:20 p.m. Big, huge line, paperwork to fill out. Nobody knew, like all this paperwork was coming off the printers, like they were making this up as they go. I filled out everything as quick as I could. There was a huge line at immigration. And I'm like, I need to get out of here. I'm going to get locked. I just had this feeling. And I was like, I need to get someplace as soon as, and I knew that there had, like in Bangkok, that there was like a fast track for business class. So, and I was like, there has to be someplace shorter. So one of my pieces of advice is if you'd see a long line, go look for a shorter one somewhere. Found it, went through at about 11:56 p.m. Saw all of the luggage from our baggage carousel on one of those carts that are tied together like a train being hauled off. I went, ran after it, grabbed my luggage. And when I did, I heard slam, 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 slam. They shut all the gates for immigration at midnight, at exactly midnight. And that's when, I don't know for certain, but the assumption is those people got stuck somewhere, possibly a quarantine. I don't know, because the quarantines went into effect the next day or two. So that literal door shut at midnight behind me.
You were minutes from disaster is what I hear.
Yep. I mean, Bangkok was still, you couldn't eat in the restaurants. It had to be takeaway. There was no quarantine yet. That was coming very shortly or very soon. And even within Thailand over the next year or two, Thailand did great that they didn't have people like COVID. They literally did not let people in. It was very difficult to get in. They controlled it very well for about a year and a half. And then when people went to go see their families for the Thai New Year, the second year, that's when COVID really hit. But the first year, they handled it, you know, case count wise, much better than the rest of the world.
So here you are, you land in Japan, you're literally taking the last flight out of Japan. You barely, narrowly, by 4 minutes, make it into the country of Thailand. At this point, do you even know where you're going from that, from there? I mean, you're probably the other side of immigration and customs. And are you figuring out, okay, am I going to go to the Grand Hyatt? Am I going to go to the Regency? Where'd you go from there?
It was a few days in Bangkok, and then Bangkok was sort of shut down. I did check out, I think it was the Moxie there for a day or two. And then I was just like, okay, surely there's, you know, better if I'm going to get stuck here also. It's like, let's go find a beach. So I went to Phuket. As soon as I got to Phuket, I was like, okay, you know, big, never been to Phuket before. I'd only been to Bangkok. And Phuket's got, you know, large beach areas throughout. That's a huge island. And the next morning I wake up, go to walk on the beach, and I get chased off by a Thai police officer. You can't walk on the beach.
Oh, wow. As a COVID restriction, you mean, or something?
It's not open air enough.
It's a COVID restriction. Yeah. So then I was like, okay, that's kind of odd. So then 2 days later, I get a knock on the door, and one of the assistant managers tells me they're shutting down. So
the hotel. Oh my! Wow. Yeah. Which hotel was this?
The La Meridian.
Oh, the La Meridian. Okay, in Phuket. The Khao Lak one or the Phuket one?
Not Khao Lak, no.
Okay.
I think that's technically the Phuket one. I could be wrong.
Okay. Got it.
If you were on the island, then it was Phuket. Yeah, because Khao Lak is off the island just north.
That one's much further north. But yeah, so that got shut down. I went to a Hilton Doubletree. That got shut down. Then I made it to a much smaller like backpack. There was nothing else open. You know, there was no tourist at that point in time. The walking street in Phuket, the big where the nightlife is, you couldn't even walk through it. It was blocked off. It was barricaded off. All the go-go bars, everything was closed on that area.
Were you at this point at all, like, was there any alarms going, bells going off in your head? I'm like, all the major resorts are shutting down. There's nobody in the tourist street. I'm now stuck in Thailand. What was going through your head? I'm just kind of curious.
I was trying to find a place to stay.
It was just more utilitarian. Bit. Like, you were just like, I am in problem-solving mode. I must find a place to sleep tonight.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
So then at that point, I found a backpack place, stayed there for like 2 days, very small, basic room. And then they knock on the door and say, hey, we need you to pay for 30 days. And I'm like, I'm not staying 30 days here.
Right.
And they're like, well, what are you going to do? And I'm like, well, I'm going to go someplace else. And they're like, well, you got to stay 30 days there too. And I'm like, what are you talking? So what had happened was they shut down all travel in the country. Mm. So if you were at a hotel, you could not move between hotels.
Oh, okay.
It had not been enacted yet. We had a few days. So I went back to the airport and I was like, okay, do I go back to Bangkok? And I just look on the board. I'm like, nothing's happening in Phuket. You can't go to the beach. You can't walk around that much. It's like, surely somewhere. So I go to the airport, look on the board, and I always pronounce Koh Samui wrong. Like, I think I said like Samoa, S-A-M-U-I. Oh.
I was going to say Koh Samui sounded right to me.
Yeah, whatever I was saying before that was wrong. Oh, okay. I looked at it. So I bought two different plane tickets.
Cajun pronunciation for Koh Samui.
Yeah. I don't know what it was, but it was absolutely wrong. So, but I had two tickets. I had a ticket back to Bangkok and I had to take it to this other place. And then I found out Samui's an island. So I get on the airplane and land there. And then there's another smaller island, Koh Phangan, which has like the big full moon party, dance party. And I'm like, surely that's nice. So I get there to that island and they're like, oh, where are you quarantining? And I'm like, oh my gosh. So they're like, you can either quarantine or go back. And I was like, well, the place, and I had just taken a ferry. Sorry, I landed in Samui, then was taking a ferry to this other smaller island. And they're like, go stand over there. They made me stand away from everybody. And when the wind direction changed, they made me go stand on another part of this big
park. Oh, you're downwind now. So, okay, we can work with you.
Like, I didn't understand. The guy was like shaking his hands at me. He's like, go move. Like, I was like, okay. But the reason I went back was at the ferry where I took it, I saw people sitting on the beach. And I was like, that's where I need to be.
If I'm going to quarantine or if I'm going to survive this COVID situation, I'm going to do it, mind you, with sand and sun and waves and surf. So it sounds infinitely better than maybe where we were at this point in the pandemic, potentially.
Yeah. So that's where I landed for actually 3 months in this small bungalow, like just a bungalow. Like there was like 30 of those bungalow rooms, beautiful beach, one of the best in Samui, but I was paying $18 a day. Very basic. So let's just be very clear about that. But
right,
spent 3 months there. Spent 3 months there. Yeah.
Well, I mean, go ahead.
So you escape the go-go bars with tumbleweeds floating past them or bouncing past them to finally make it to a beach. So 3 months, did 3 months turn into 6 months? Did 3 months turn into longer?
Yeah. So stayed at that place 3 months. And then little by little, I wouldn't say things opened up, but Samui, you know, everybody wore masks 100%. There was nobody who didn't wear a mask. That's just the Thai culture. But little by little, all the tourists who were sort of stuck there, not people like me who just showed up, but there's a lot of Russian, a lot of French people, tourists who were long-term tourists started going home back to their country. And little by little, the tourism industry ended. And I do want to clarify, even though, you know, I'm sitting on the beach, just I was very acutely aware that I'll give a story of my motorbike that I was renting after about 2 months from the same couple. They owned about 30 motorbikes. She called me and said, hey, can you bring the motorbike in? I was like, oh, okay. I thought she meant she just wanted the week's payment at that point in time. But no, she needed the motorbike because they had to close down their shop because they hadn't rented a motorbike in 2 months to anybody for me. And if you know Samui, after all the tourism shut down, so similar to the Phuket walking street, there's a large beach for Samui that's very popular, lots of clubs, tours, things like that. After there's nobody watching those stores, it, over time, it just became dilapidated. People lost their livelihood. Thailand's just a huge tourism. And when that just completely shut, there's other countries that are like that, but Thai is almost all tourism. So little by little, especially on Samui, just the buildings that were there were dilapidated because the owners, you know, even if they rented, you know, the rent was gone completely. They just bailed. Then even the owners just gave up on the buildings. And little by little, it you could tell and watch it affected the larger places first, then the other smaller places after that.
So we went from an escape movie to a post-apocalyptic movie is what I have in my head. You know, so I'm thinking about the movies that I'm watching, you know, the Chris movies, and there was, you know, the race through the airport, and you're going through the door, grabbing your hat from the door that's about to slam down, you know, a la Indiana Jones. Now we're in like kind of like Walking Dead or something where, you know, you have this street with all these storefronts and everything that's dilapidated and not kept up because there's no customers, right? There's no, the owners have left, they've abandoned their spaces. That's just really interesting. You would think that I mean, it makes sense, but it just doesn't. I wouldn't have thought about it that, you know, when you have a 100% tourist industry economy, right, like a coastal movie where there really isn't any other things, I would imagine there, that you're right. It gets complete desolation if there are no visitors.
So I have to ask, you're there for quite some time. The other tourists have all left. Do you find that you're seeing some locals regularly that, you know, are they starting to accept you as part of their community, part of their, you know, surviving together, we're all in this together sort of a thing?
Yeah. And one thing that the country did very well was the government subsidies did pay out for hotels to keep their employees. I mean, lots of them went back home to wherever their family was. Some were able to stay open. A lot of the smaller ones, I mean, many were shut down for certain, but the ones that did stay open, half, if not three-fourths of the payroll was covered by the government. But then being the only guest, when I got to that bungalow, there were probably 8 of us out of 30, 40 rooms. And then very quickly, it was 5, then 3. And there were other hotels that I went to later on that I stayed at, the same situation, like this one beautiful villa that normally would be $600 a night for their basic room. It's $45 at that point. And because they were just looking to get anything from anybody you possibly, once Bangkok could open up to Samui, they had a few more expats come onto the island. But then the island itself, so there was a quarantine for all of the country. There was a separate quarantine for Samui. So if you wanted to get to Samui, you had to go through two quarantines. So even if you lived in Bangkok, you couldn't come to Samui without a quarantine for a little while. But little by little, there was the core people. But then I ate breakfast with the same people who worked there. So a lot of them I call my friends, but, you know, they eventually moved on because their family was going through trouble. They had to go take care of their parents who got COVID. So then they had to leave their jobs there. So even if they could have stayed, they needed to go take care of their mom or dad who lived in a different province. So little by little, people left for different reasons.
So Chris, can you give us a timestamp of this? Like, so when they started implementing that second quarantine, when was that? Was that what part of, like, was that in 2020? Was that a little bit later or?
It actually happened twice, if I recall. The quarantine itself for Samui happened because the provincial travel stopped for a good while. So several months. So middle summer of 2020. Then what happened was when the Thai New Year's came up, that wasn't allowed. Travel wasn't allowed again. But then the second Thai New Year that came around, they actually have a king said, okay, everybody can go see their family now because a lot of them had not been.
They opened up the domestic travel at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
And was that 21 isn't essentially? Or
yeah, that would have been about a year and a half, I think, into there. And then at that point, that's when COVID really hit the country. So it's like it happened everywhere else, but they had covered it so well to begin with. Once that travel opened up, it was too late.
You know,
then they really went through their normal, what everybody else in the world had gone through.
Because, you know, Thailand is so connected, right? Because, I mean, when you're talking about the French and the Russians and, you know, like the diaspora of people that come to Koh Samui or to Phuket or Bangkok, you know, it's so many. So it's kind of amazing that they didn't have a bigger outbreak at the beginning, but it sounds like really they did almost everything right. And then once they did open up, even domestically without any foreign visitors, that was enough to kind of start things going.
Yeah, because Bangkok, you know, was the epicenter for Thailand. Koh Samui and even north, like, you know, the northern part of the country or outside in the cities, they were all pretty good. But then once Bangkok got allowed to go out, that's when things kind of, you know, got a hand for the rest of the country. And then another shutdown happened. So at that point, that's when the other quarantine of you can't come to. And Samui was very lucky that, you know, they handled that very well. You know, it's an island separate from everybody, and it's kind of difficult to get to. There's one or two ferries, and then there's Bangkok Airlines, which is a private airline. So it's not that well traveled to outside of the locals. Like Bangkok people wouldn't come to Samui very often. So that's one detriment there. But, you know, once they set it off to where it was more difficult, then Samui actually held up very well. There were very few cases of COVID on the island of Koh Samui for like the first year and a half. We're talking maybe 100.
So I've got two questions for you. The first question, and then I'll pause. There's another notable person that enjoyed the pandemic, enjoyed, quote mark, lived out the pandemic on Koh Samui. Did you end up getting the chance to meet Justin Ross Lee?
Yes, I did. For like, I think he showed up to the Hyatt Regency Samui a couple of days. So funny story about that. Yeah. So he had been living in Thailand well before COVID. So I can't remember for how long. I mean, he speaks some decent Thai. But the Hyatt Regency Koh Samui opened in the middle of the pandemic. I tell you why, because I drove by it. I was like, they don't have this place ready. It's not going to open. I'd lived there for 5 months when it opened. I was the very first customer there. But the reason it did open during the pandemic is that the Buddhist monks determine when you get married, when, you know, different things, business cycles, things like that. So the monks had actually determined what day it should open. And when the monks say, hey, you need to open in 4 months, you open no matter what. So they did. It was a gorgeous ceremony, full day worth of, you know, it started like 8 a.m, you know, ceremony and all this things I did not know about. And another thing sort of travel related. So Hyatt, when they open a new hotel, they have to have an inspection to say, okay, is this hotel up to standard? But Hyatt Corporate couldn't send anyone to the hotel. So there was nobody available to go to visit outside of Hyatt Corporate. So because they would have to quarantine for 14 days. So what they did is they had the GM from the Park Hyatt Bangkok, who had recently opened that hotel. He's Australian. He was obviously living in Bangkok, so he could come down freely. So he came down for and stayed for like the week before and then the next 2 weeks just to kind of give advice and everything. So that's how I met the GM of the Park Hyatt Bangkok. So we hung out. But at the Hyatt Regency Samui, I mean, there were days to where I was the only guest there. So it's about 200 rooms, gorgeous hotel, you know, obviously brand new. But on the weekends, there'd be a few expats, people who lived in Samui, who just wanted their kids to come out and play in the pool. They would just get a room, but hanging out with the GM of the Park Hyatt in Bangkok. But then he went home, and then I, you know, there were times there was just nobody at the hotel, and it was fully staffed. I mean, there was 70, 80 people working at the hotel. Yeah, that was kind of weird in terms of like being at a resort like that all to yourself. And I have to like process having that experience. Everybody wants to fly first class and be the only person in the cabin, right? That's
right.
That's cool. I've had that.
Being the only person. Yeah, yeah. And it's great. It's phenomenal. Just walking around, you know, you can just walk around, do whatever you want to in first class. You're the only person. But being at a resort and walking around and there's literally nothing going on. People are attending to their own job responsibilities, but there's nobody to talk to. There's no interaction. You know, you can go to the beach, but then what do you do after that? Then you go sit at the pool. Then you, after a while, it's just kind of surreal. But then in the background, I knew that people were losing their jobs. Their livelihood was changing. People were dying. And it was like, I'm just very fortunate to have that experience. But I did want to share. I kept taking pictures, just, you know, people showing, here's what's really happening in these countries that are losing their tourism.
You know, surreal is the exact word I had in my mind as you're talking about this. It becomes kind of a gilded cage, right, in a way, you know, because it is beautiful. It sounds lovely. But at the same time, you're right. But, you know, at the same time, you know, I think many of us were probably feeling similar ways in the depth of of the pandemic, whether it be in 2021, where, you know, we had to make excuses and you know, this do this kinds of like, you know, virtual social interacting, right? Because, you know, it wasn't happening in real life anyway. So I guess in some ways I don't understand. And in other ways, I'm like, I can completely relate. Because if I put myself back into kind of the depths of the pandemic, I can remember bits and pieces of it.
And talking about the gilded cage, when the spike hit in Bangkok after about a year and a half, so I stayed at the Grand Hyatt for a total of 6 months in Bangkok. It was like two months, went back to Samui. Because for the longest time, I couldn't leave Samui because if I left, I couldn't come back. So I stayed there. But then finally when it was like, okay, I didn't want something to happen and not be able to come back. So I was very hesitant to actually leave to go to Bangkok or go to Phuket or something.
I could see that.
But one time when I went to the Grand Hyatt Bangkok, I think both of y'all have been there, right?
Of course. Oh, yes.
At that big, huge shopping mall, that big, huge intersection.
Yeah. With the shrine and everything, the Erewhon shrine, right? Yep.
Oh, yeah. And Central World.
That intersection right there, I've walked out and stood in the middle of the road and took a 360-degree picture.
With like nobody around?
Because there was nobody driving. Wow. at early that night. That's how little traffic there was.
I can't even imagine. Like it just blows my mind that you could be in that part of Bangkok and just have it be just
for minutes.
For minutes.
Wow. Not just the red light. I stood there and there was nobody. Nobody. So that's how that was. And then talking about the gilded cage, then there was more shutdowns. The lounge closed. So you were, you know, by 9 p.m., you had to stay in your room. You couldn't go to the lounge. So then they shut the lounge down and then you could just order room service the whole time. And then that was another alarm. You know, everybody wants room service, right? You know, and I was like, things are getting worse. Let's go back to Samui. But there were times to where, you know, the hotel was had the Grand Hyatt had like 30 people. And then getting the lounge room, I could order a bottle of champagne. They're like, oh, do you want the whole bottle? It's like, okay, well, I don't have anything else to do. And then at that point, I was like, okay, when you shut the lounge down and there's a curfew at 9 p.m., we could get stuck here again. I was like, I'm going back to Samui. So then I went back to Samui.
I mean, those spa cottages are nice, but I don't think I'd want to be stuck there.
And you couldn't go out to the pool. You couldn't go out to the pool either. So.
Oh, well, that's no fun at all. So I want to kind of drive us a little bit, you know, further here. So you've been through two shutdowns at this point in Thailand. You stuck around for the opening, I assume. Talk us through that. And where were you? I think, if I recall from your notes, you spent some time on Koh Samui, but you also made it back to Bangkok. I don't know if you made it down to Phuket for that opening, during that opening period. But talk through, you know, your experiences. Talk through the emotions that you sort of observed. Because, I mean, at this point, you are among the Thai people. You know, you're a member of the Thai people. You might not look like a Thai, but, I mean, you've spent enough time with them to understand, you know, some of the emotions that they went through during the 18 to 24 month period. Just walk us through that reopening experience.
And Nit Noi Thai, Nit Noi, that means little bit, like little spicy. And one thing, and everybody asked me, is like, how good is your Thai? And I'm like, I never learned Thai because I always thought I was going home soon. So I learned a little bit, but you know, like we said earlier, nobody expected it to be this long. And I was like, well, you know, if I learn it, I'm leaving soon, or, you know, there was always something else. But one thing, thinking about the sort of reopening was I did two, and this goes back to travel and airplanes. I actually went to Phuket when the first international flight landed. It was a Qatar flight, that first international flight back into Thailand. There was huge media coverage. So I was like, okay, I want to go down and see that. So we were able to fly from Samui to Phuket. And that was really emotional, being able to see everybody happy. It was like our life is starting to come back with these few people. The plane was not packed by, you know, maybe 75 people. The plane was not packed. But as soon as those first people came in, and they had to quarantine, but they knew those people after quarantine were going to be tourists. I was like, okay, our lifeblood is coming back there. That was really emotional. Another one, even though it's not Thai related, I just happened upon the first, make sure I get this straight, the first flight from London to the U.S. in JFK. That one was also really emotional because there were families lined up that the travel restrictions, I can't remember the details, like I don't think you could leave the U.K. There was something that was extra special about the U.K. or something to where, you know, but there were people who had been separated from their families, or like they couldn't come over from the U.K. I can't remember, it was some weird difference between, I think they weren't allowed out of the U.K. or something like that. I can't remember. But when that first BA flight landed, there was all sorts of people, signs, just happy to see families who had been separated for years at this point. That was something that wasn't shared, you know, in the media as much, but seeing that and kind of understanding, okay, you've been separate, or, you know, somebody was supposed to get married 2 weeks as soon as the quarantine, you know, shutdown started, and they had to postpone their wedding 2 years. Stuff like that, really seeing the travel, sort of the industry side about how that happened, that was really unique and special, and not just meeting people, but it being able to see their emotion, what they were feeling through that, and just being able to experience that. That was something that really meant a lot over the time.
And I remember that. I remember that first flight, because if I recall correctly, they had Virgin and British Airways take off at the exact same time.
Yeah, you're right.
out of London Heathrow. Yes. They made a big deal about that flight, I suppose those two flights. That was an emotional thing, at least to watch from afar, and you had the opportunity to witness that in person.
I don't really remember how I got there, but when I found out it was that day and I happened to be in JFK, I mean, this would have been two and a half years later. I just remember London being something, it took a lot longer or something like that. But I made a point to go over to that terminal. And then I saw where exit of immigration is, where everything was set up. Yeah, that was really...
So when did you actually finally escape Thailand? Like, can we go to that part of the movie now? Where
it was right over 2 years. I think is how long it was. Yeah,
that's incredible. 2 years. How do you even deal with that from a visa standpoint? Like, how do you even stay in the country that long?
Oh, they kept extending it. Now, you did have to go in and do the paperwork, et cetera, but then they did a visa. It was free extensions every 60 days.
Wow. Well, I mean, it totally makes sense. I mean, they kind of don't give you too many options. So,
and they need you. They would need people.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So before we leave Thailand, before we leave the sort of escape or I suppose escape from the COVID lockdowns, we've talked to folks that have done long-term travel, but I don't think we've talked to anybody that has done as long-term travel as you have. You're in Thailand for 2 years. I'll just say I have prescriptions I need, not to share your medical stuff, but like you literally left with what, a suitcase and a backpack, and you're living out of that suitcase and backpack for 2 years. How do you make do? What sort of things did you need to do to try to just ensure that you had everything you needed to be able to, continue to live comfortably and, you know, take care of all of your needs?
Well, I've been fortunate to only had one medical issue during the 2 years over there. And the medical situation in Thailand is actually quite nice. I didn't have to experience it. It wasn't that bad. But from what I hear, you know, plenty of people take the medical tourism to Thailand. So there's sort of Thai medicine. And there's English hospitals and local hospitals. So there's, you know, ways that they keep that, you know, much easier for people like me to be able to navigate. When I left, like I said, a month, I took a carry-on, you know, with the, you know, pair of long pants, a couple of pairs of shorts, some sandals. That was it. But then little by little, you know, it just, you know, Samui, one thing about Thailand and Samui especially, it's just like, sometimes it just takes a long time to do something. Like if I needed to get a photo.
Island time.
Yeah. I mean, it just, and stuff like, and even just for, you know, now that I'm doing something different, being on the road, just sometimes it takes a lot of time to do something that would be normal. Like, you know, just not necessarily just getting groceries, but all of a sudden you need this one thing and it takes you an hour and a half to go find it. Or if I need something certified, or I didn't bring my passport to the post office. I'm like, oh, but it took 45 minutes to get to the post office. So now just little things just add up to sort of that lifestyle that's a little different in terms of.
By the way, to take us on a small tangent, just, you know, on the backs of our everyday carry episode, what team are you from a luggage perspective?
It's purely a carry-on.
So are you team Briggs & Riley?
I actually just like literally today. So if we ever, wind up talking about the SAS trip, I've actually had my luggage lost for the last month. and I purchased, because my Briggs & Riley got ripped during that. So I sent it in. And they're like, yeah, we can't replace it. So I just ordered a brand new, the 21 International, the gray one, the silverish gray one.
Oh, I don't think I've seen the gray one.
It literally just came in an hour ago.
Wait. They said that they couldn't replace it. Could they repair it?
Sorry, they couldn't repair it. They had to replace it. So I just got the replacement.
You got a brand new carry-on, huh? That doesn't suck.
That sounds like a warranty that I want to get behind.
And just for clarification on their side, if they can't, you can either get a sample of exactly what you have for free, or you can get a $350 credit and then buy whatever else you want. So I actually traded colors. I thought the silver, I think it's called gray or silver, whatever that new and limited edition is. I just wanted to be a little bit different. So, but yeah, I'm team Briggs & Riley, carry on, and just a backpack. It's just easier.
Another testimonial for teams Briggs & Riley, which Trevor and I were on. And I did notice, you know, when we saw each other not too long ago, you know, I was like, I think Chris is a member of the club.
Yeah, by far.
Okay. Well, any final thoughts as we transition from COVID discussion, because you've got another really interesting topic that we definitely want to cover. Any final thoughts on the pandemic spent in Thailand?
No, just the people of Thailand. I never lived. I've always traveled, but never really stayed anywhere that long. By no means by that long. You know, 2 weeks in all of my other travels would be fairly extensive. But, you know, kind of opened my eyes in terms of what living over there. Now, I didn't live there per se. I lived in hotels. So that's a different lifestyle if you're living in hotels. So it's not like going expat or retirement. That's a little bit different. So, but had lovely time. I mean, I love going back to the prices are going, like, I paid $35 for the Grand Hyatt Bangkok for those, you know, 5 months, 6 months.
I was paying. I think those days are gone, unfortunately.
Yeah, those days are gone. Even some movies now, if you get under 200, you're doing really good. And I think it was 70, 75. Samui's beautiful place. Thai people were always, only had one incident that I'd speak negative of, but a lovely country. I try to get back, you know, every probably 6 months now. But just
considering how long you were there and under the stressful conditions, that sounds like a win. You know, like it sounds like you lucked out in a way. I mean, it some cases it sounds like it was a bit of a gilded cage, but at least it was a gilded cage with a lot of benefits and nice people and a culture that I think was accommodating.
Yeah, I think, you know, with so many things going on that were negative, I like to try to think that I helped out in that situation. I wouldn't call it a win-win because, you know, what else is going on in the world? But I like to think that, you know, somebody was there to kind of help out, and I did my best to go. Like when I went back for the one-year anniversary of the Hyatt Regency opening, I tipped the entire staff that was there for the whole year. I did a party for them. There was a party. And then I tipped out, financially tried to support them for that. So, you know, because it meant so much to see them again a year later.
That's just cool.
A year after I'd already left.
Wow. Despite having that time and a little bit of a challenging circumstances for why you were there, it seems like you've got a warm place in your heart for Thailand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. First of all, thank you for sharing that. I think our listeners will really, really appreciate just probably a completely different perspective than what many of us had.
A unique perspective.
Absolutely. I followed, you know, your messages when you were sort of sharing them. We were kind of living vicariously through you. Another thing that I think some of us were living vicariously through you on is a more recent event. So I think, and I'm sure Tom's going to correct me here, but sometime over the summer, SAS departed Star Alliance, right? I think they were Star Alliance, and they're now part of SkyTeam. And they did this really cool promotion where if you flew, I think it was 15 airlines, you would earn 1 million SAS
air miles. All the SkyTeam partners, right, is essentially what you would have to do?
All of the sort of active, yeah. There's actually 19 SkyTeam partners, but because of limitations of four others, it was 50.
Four others, a.k.a. I think S, is it S9, S7, which is a Russian
airline? No, well, I think that's those are Oneworld, right?
Is S7? Oh, okay. It's Aeroflot.
So point of clarification. So Aeroflot was, I can't remember the terminology. They're sort of not in SkyTeam anymore.
Oh, really? But
they were like ITA Airlines, the Italian, they were moving, so that didn't qualify. Then Middle Eastern Airlines, MEA, it was Beirut, so that wasn't one of the 19. And then there were only 17 where you could actually earn. I hope I'm doing this right. 17 that you could earn, but you had to fly 15. So you had that sort of buffer of two. But
they gave you a little bit of grace, a little bit. A
little bit of room to work.
ITA, you would not earn credit. And then even if you flew MEA, it wasn't one of the 15 or something like that. So I actually wound up flying. I intently and purposefully flew all 19 just to say it.
Just to be able to say it.
Overachiever. You wanted to be an overachiever.
It's a completist. Or what is it? Yeah.
So walk us through this. You know, the experience or the promotion was what, a couple few months?
Just barely 2 months, I think. Yeah. They announced it fairly quick. Like everybody was like, hey, can we spread it out a little more? Because that's a lot of flying in the long run.
It really is.
They announced it, and I think it started maybe 2 weeks later. It was something, and I was like, oh, I'm doing this. So we're going to make this happen.
It's so funny to see, like, the gauntlet has been laid down. And how many people picked up that gauntlet? I mean, it's just a testament to the crazy nuts people that we have in the community. I mean, because I'm like thinking, who's going to do this? And then you see the number of people, and the uptake is incredible. Like it was so many more people than I thought, you know, to be completely honest.
I don't know if they'll ever say how many actually did it. One way that I was putting it into perspective of what that number would be was on the Kenyan Air Fifth Freedom from Bangkok to Canton, China. You know those boarding gates where you actually sort of clear security again to get to the gate? So then everybody's just sitting.
The secured, like waiting area that they put you in.
A waiting area there. So the Kenyan Air flight only had maybe 40, 50 people total, but it had come in from Nairobi, stopped in Bangkok, and then went on to Canton, and then went back. I was just looking around, and I was like, who looks like they'd be doing something like this? So I intentionally walked by these two guys. One was in the lounge in Bangkok. It's the Air France lounge that we were using. I saw a guy on his SAS app. I was like, that's kind of odd. And I'm like, if you're using
some clues,
it's not. So then when I saw the same dude in the waiting area, he was talking to somebody else. So I kind of walked over really slowly and listening to the conversation, didn't want to like interrupt him. But then I heard him say something like SES this.
I love this part of this podcast, by the way, because I cannot tell you. There almost needs to be a phrase for this where, you know, you are on a mileage run and you see the same person in the airport lounge that was there with you earlier. And then you see them on the next leg and you're like, okay, I know what you're doing. You are on the same line. And then you automatically feel like, okay, I can come up to this guy because he clearly is a points and miles person, because who's doing this crazy stuff where, you know, you're basically, you know, going right back on back-to-back flights or whatever. There's got to be some sort of like, we got to come up with a miles and points term for this, because this has happened so many times, right? Where you're on the plane, you notice this person like, oh, wait, I saw that guy on that flight. And then, oh, I'm seeing him again, you know, like.
And it's not just the connection. It's like you're going back to where you just left.
Exactly.
We're all when you
double,
together.
It's like the double back or something like that is what you need to call it. Because that is something that I would like to say has happened to me a fair number of times. And I feel like that's exactly what you're talking about right there.
So the three of us started talking and we just kind of got loud and everything like that. And then this Indian couple walks up to us. They're like, oh, are you doing Million Miler also? So it turned out there were five of us right there. There could have been more. I mean, I don't know.
I think loud talking, by the way, is another, you know, characteristic of this particular scenario, because that has always been my problem. Is like, I'll run into them, then we start talking loud, and then people are like, would you guys shut up? I mean, you're so damn loud.
Well, you get excited.
I know
get
you do.
Get excited about
when
this
when you
stuff,
meet another you one of loud. Your species in the wild, it's great. Anyway, sorry about that. I just needed to put a little tangent in there, because it just really was very meaningful for me just then.
And talking about timing, this was early on. So I started maybe a week after. So I flew.
Oh, early adopter. Taipei.
Yeah, I started pretty early on. And then, but I spent like, I did some vacation in the middle. Like I was in Hainan for like a week. But this was my segment number 6 at that point in time. And this is probably 2 or 3 weeks into the promotion, maybe 4.
Wait, I gotta interrupt you for a second. You said you spent a week in Hainan, China?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll get back to this promotion in a second. But so you're probably one of the first people that I've talked to since the pandemic that has actually spent meaningful amount of time in China. How was the experience? And what would you go back?
Well, I was going to spend more time because I planned on getting my 10-year visa before taking this trip, because it would have made things a lot easier because of all the transit issues. Hainan is one of the places to where you can I want to say they're 30 days, kind of like.
This is the transit without visa program, essentially, like there's certain cities, right, that you have extended non-visa access?
Or? Yeah, Macau. And then I don't know what Hong Kong, you know, that one always gets a little sticky.
Because those are all special administrative regions, but then I think there's certain gateway cities as well within
Chengdu or
Shanghai. So it gets a little confused. So the gateway, and if you do the transit without visa, you have to. The thing about Hong Kong is if you enter Hainan, and I know this from experience because I got chased down by immigration. So I came in from Hong Kong and was trying to go to, I can't remember where, but they didn't allow me on the plane. Like, I'd already cleared immigration, left the airport, you know, in the airport. I'm about to board the flight. They came and got me and said, where did you come from? I was like, I flew in from Hong Kong. It's like, you got to go back to Hong Kong then. You can't. I was trying to go to Xiaomin. That's what I was trying
to do. Okay.
To pick up another segment.
Because that's one of the other SkyTeam members, right? Xiaomin Airlines.
And they're like, no, you can't do that. I'm like, I'm just transiting. So it's once I realized all the transit information for China is one or the other, not combinable, it started making a lot more sense. But to Trevor, to your question, I actually plan to spend in the next month or two some significant time in China. In Hainan, it was more... You know, I don't know what it was like before COVID, but it never crossed my mind. There was never any COVID, like, any concerns or anything about that. It was just, you know, kind of normal.
That's just like a tropical island, right, in China, is Hainan?
Yeah, it's actually very close to, so the general manager of the Hyatt Regency Samui is now the general manager of the Hyatt Regency Da Nang, Vietnam. And literally, if you have a pair of binoculars, you can look from Hainan to Da Nang.
Wow, it's that close. Oh, I didn't realize.
It's that close. There's no flights and there's no ferries. I don't know why, but...
Is that Haiphong Bay or is that further north of Haiphong Bay? Because I thought Haiphong Bay was pretty close to China too. So that's interesting though. I didn't ask that from a COVID perspective. I asked that more just... because they were very, very slow to open and, you know, capacity still is incredibly slow. And so I was just curious, you know, sort of the experience, considering there's just not as many.
Is it the capacity or is it the demand? Because, you know, I feel like the Chinese carriers are still flying, right? Especially their dedicated routes internationally. But I feel like there just isn't the same business demand and the same, you know, kind of leisure demand that there was back pre-pandemic.
Right. But that contributes to the question in, you know, so here you are, an American visiting China, and in years past, you'd be one of many. And now you're one of a few potentially in proportion.
Well, intra-China travel is off the charts. Planes.
Oh, I believe that. Yeah.
The capacity, or I don't know about the capacity, but there's flights everywhere all the time, morning, noon, night, red eye, everything. That's so if it's a question of, hey, what about international travel to the rest of Asia? I know the capacity to the U.S. is very limited. I want to say, and that's more of a government restrictions, who's going to open up and do more flights or Chinese. I'm not so sure about that. But the intra-China and then also intra-Asia, it's booming. It's booming. I don't, you know, if it's personal or business, I'm not sure, but it's tight. Planes are packed.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. So, you know, definitely appreciate that. I know the U.S. has a parity thing where if Air China gets a flight, then United or one of the U.S. flights, et cetera. But I mean, you know, the U.S. airlines also have the challenge of they only have so many wide bodies, so they might not want to allocate. I mean, you know, for example, I think we've got more capacity going to Australia than we usually do. We've got, you know, United finding other interesting, you know, I think United takes a dartboard out, but that's a topic for another podcast.
And, you know, I think a lot of the Western carriers are at a disadvantage because they're not going through Russian airspace, right?
And oh, so yeah, that as well. Yeah.
So a lot of the Chinese native carriers are doing that. So they're almost at a advantage, you know, providing the international gateway services that they're assigned to by the government. Because I think it's basically each international pair, you know, it's like it's only one Chinese carrier that gets it, so they don't compete with each other.
Yeah, it's easy to forget the impact of that Russian airspace overfly when you're going to China and to the Pacific.
Talking about the Russian air, so leaving from, and this wasn't the million mile thing, I left from, I want to say Taipei to Vienna on a nonstop flight. It flew because of wind. I was talking to Brander about this or something, but look, I had a picture of the route. You could see it on the seat back. It went from Taipei to Singapore around the bottom of India.
Wow.
And then up toward Europe. I was sitting in coach.
Oh, no.
It was, the flight was like 3.5 hours longer than what it was blocked. Like when I woke up and I saw like, we're only in India. And I was like, we are nowhere near where we're supposed to be going. But
is China Airlines another SkyTeam carrier or?
Oh yeah. That would have been China Airlines. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you think that's because of the relationships going on with India, China, and the whole, you know, Taiwan issue?
I think from what Brander said was they can't go the north route. And then the winds picked up or something, you know, obviously it was an optimized as best as it could.
They can't go over China because, and so if they can't go over India, you got Everest and stuff there. Yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, he actually did say because of the mountain. That's actually one of the things. Yeah. Like I said, I'm not an expert on that, but it was a long flight.
I don't envy you in economy on that kind of a flight.
I know. I do a lot of cash tickets too, because then I book last minute.
So, any other interesting highlights on your million mile? I mean, clearly you did all of SkyTeam carriers, whether they counted or not. So that's got to be a handful of Chinese carriers. That's Kenyan. I'm trying to think, there's got to be a couple other kind of airlines that you wouldn't normally think of. Perhaps Aerolíneas Argentinas.
Yeah, so that was one of the big ones that caused a little bit of a hiccup. Like, I mean, getting to Argentina, but. The good thing about that one was I was leaving from Spain, flew up to France. The pricing on this flight, it's round trip from Paris to JFK to Buenos Aires, round trip, $750. And I was able to use a global upgrade, comes on Diamond, on Delta in business class. It was a huge bargain. But getting down there to add on that very last carrier, that was time consuming, a little expensive, but I was like, do I really want to do that 19th one? I was like, nobody else is. Somebody's got to do it. So. But
the lengths that you went.
Yeah. Yeah. With that, it was more of like, you know, I wish I would have stayed in Argentina longer. I'd been there 20, 25 years ago. The architecture when I was, because a lot of these places, I didn't stay. Like the European leg and some of the within Asia, I had stayed in Vietnam for a while. I stayed in Hainan, but that wasn't even one of the SkyTeam legs. But going out and just seeing other places, I wish I would have stayed in Argentina a little bit more. And then just one or two places, like I got to go back. But, you know, there's some time restraints and it was getting in to be the holidays, closer to that. I guess one of the other highlights of that particular trip was I was able to go to the Delta One Lounge in Boston for their opening. And I've actually been to all of, I was the first customer in JFK for the opening of the Delta One Lounges. And Tom and I were talking about that. Tom has a lifetime Sky Club membership that he bought. What are the details, Tom?
Oh, well, I was, you know, originally a Northwest, you know, elite member. So back in 2005, I think, is when I bought this, or 2006. I have to actually go back and remember when this was that I purchased this. But I bought a lifetime World Club membership from Northwest Airlines. And that has since converted into a Delta Sky Club lifetime membership, which is one of my most treasured items because, you know, they have graciously, Delta has continued to allow me to use it. And not only that, I can use it while I'm flying other carriers and invite two guests. So basically, it's like an executive membership to the Sky Club that I can use when I'm not even flying Delta, which is limited, I think, just to its lifetime memberships.
That's better members. Than investing in Delta or in Tesla.
Yeah. Or Northwest Airlines stock at the time. They did go bankrupt eventually, so, you know.
The Delta One Lounge opening, those lounges are very nice. Not just the lounge itself, the food, you know, who knows if that's going to stay at that high level, but JFK is huge. LA's nice, a good bit smaller. And then Boston is actually more of just a restaurant style, but seafood focused. The appetizer on the menu now is like this huge 4 oysters, huge shrimps.
Wow. It's like your own little
appetizer.
Like, yeah. Wow. Huge. It's your own little raw bar or something.
Yeah. I've liked all of the Delta One lounges. I've been to several flagships. I've never been Polaris, but I've been Concord Room, you know, Pier, you know, Hunk, all the other big ones. The D1 lounges are pretty nice.
I'm excited to go. I have unfortunately yet to make my way to them. Hopefully Trevor and I can make it there sometime this year. They definitely appear to be in the upper echelon of airline lounges in the North America at this point.
We've probably crafted 2 or 3 itineraries to try to do that, and we've had to cancel them. That's true. For our trips, I think we cancel probably 2 to 3 times the amount of itineraries that we actually fly.
I've never been, denied boarding on as many flights with this man, and I've never canceled so many tickets as with this man. You know, he is an IROP and cancellation machine. I think the airlines will look at him and be like, okay, oh, wow, we had a real bump in cancellation fees lately. I was like, who's Trevor Mountcastle? Why are we getting so much revenue from him? You know?
In all fairness, I've been denied boarding. I don't think you and I together have been denied boarding. I mean, we've always flown.
We've just had to reopen flights. We've had to have them reopen a lot of flights. This is not behavior that I've experienced with any other travel companion. It is unique to you. So you monopolize this particular aspect of flying. Anyway, well, tangent
your
over.
Your other travel companions are boring. It's a simple answer.
He's throwing major shade at my friends. Thank you, Trevor. Thank you very much. I love that you enjoyed those Delta One lounges and even helped open some up from a ribbon cutting perspective. I think that's amazing. I'm curious, after doing all of this, are there any particular legs that you were on? Are there any of the SkyTeam carriers that you're excited to get back on now that you've tried all of them in the Alliance?
Well, actually, ITA. So I said ITA until I heard an Italian flight attendant say ITA Airlines. Is leaving SkyTeam. Actually, I think it just happened officially.
I think this, like a couple days ago or something.
Yeah. But there, I flew on there and I couldn't get their A321XLR, something like the longer range single aisle plane. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They have, at least what the flight attendant said, it's their same business class seat as on their wide bodies. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That seat was very nice. But this was like Cairo to Rome. So it was only like a four and a half hour flight. That was nice. One thing I did learn that's, you know, take away from your listeners was, and I knew this, but I just hadn't really applied it or done enough travel. Because a lot of these were smaller, you know, a lot of these flights, I think the average I did was like 1,500 miles per flight was the average.
So a lot of shorter flights.
Yeah, because I wanted to, you know, when you're doing 50, like
you got to maximize.
The one thing I'm most proud of is actually my Asian flights. Like, I knocked out Asia in a heartbeat. There was the one day, because I didn't have the Chinese visa, I flew four segments in under 24 hours and went to a free transit hotel offside of the airport.
Dedication.
Yeah, that was quick. Running it or figuring out how to upgrade, either through a couple of different options, checking just to buy it outright, like the KLM Fifth Freedom that I flew from, oh my gosh, I'm probably going to get this wrong, like Jakarta to, no, not Bali, Jakarta to Kuala Lumpur. No, that wouldn't be right either.
To Singapore, maybe? You flew this, didn't you? Didn't you fly this Fifth Freedom, Trevor? The KLM Fifth Freedom?
Yeah. There's two of them. So, Kuala Lumpur. Oh, it would be Kuala Lumpur. Oh, Malaysia to Indonesia. Yeah, that's what it is. Kuala Lumpur to Jakarta on KLM. The price of premium economy, so like, because it's a wide body, was only like $20 more than coach. Okay, that's a no-brainer. Then I bid for an upgrade like $40 on another one on a three-hour flight. Then was able to upgrade at the gate for Vietnam for like $30. So all of these different options for U.S. Airlines, you don't bid. You're probably not going to, you don't buy it at the gate. Gate agent would have no idea to do that. All these other options on these, you know, nine big three airlines, you know, Lufthansa even has stuff, you know, with British Airways, you can, you know, upgrade with Avios. If you buy coach, then it's only the price difference. It gets a little bit easier, but looking at that, that's a takeaway of something I would look into. Like even recently, I flew Malaysia Airlines separately from this, and I was able to upgrade. They were flying a wide body on a two-hour flight, which is just crazy, but I was able to upgrade for like $35, and then I inquired about how much an upgrade would be from Kuala Lumpur to London. You know, that's significant, and they're like, oh, it's $200, just flat fee.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no-brainer.
What?
No-brainer.
So it's just asking those questions or knowing to ask, and who to ask, you know, get an email, check this email from seatbidding.com or whatever it is. Just pay attention to that or ask around, because, you know, there could be significant savings like Seoul to Hong Kong. That's not short, but you could upgrade on that.
That reminds me of a story, you know, Chris' story, right? Because, you know, if you recall, like the first time I saw you in a couple of months ago after a long time was, of all places, a Spirit Airlines flight. If you recall.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the big front seat. Yeah, because you were sitting
there. I think we had all upgraded. You would all bid for upgrades. I was like, who bid over me, you know, for this big front seat? Because, you know, I did the minimum bid. I was like, you've been outbid. And I'm like, what? Who outbid me? And of course, it was probably either you or some other. Because, you know, of course, there's four of us, you know, miles and points people. And we dominated the big front seat cabin on this. I think we were going to San Antonio for a meetup.
Yeah, San Antonio. From last year. There were eight seats. And I think we knew like five people.
Pretty much. I just think that was just really funny. You know, just speaking of, again, opportunities to bid and to upgrade, it's not only just Forward Airlines. You know, I think you may even see that opportunity on some of our, you know, ultra low cost carriers like Spirit in this case. But you're absolutely right. You know, and I have made use of those in the past, like years ago. I don't know if they still do this, like KLM, for instance. You know, you would go to the Crown Room in Amsterdam. And if you happen to be in coach, you know, they would often have reasonable cash upgrades. I think and it was still, you know, it was not insignificant. I think I paid one time, I spent like maybe $500 or something like that to upgrade business class from coach on KLM. This has got to be 15 years ago, guys. So, you know, please take this data point with a grain of salt. But it was at the end of a really long trip. And I was just like, I am done. I am not getting in this coach seat. What is going to cost me to upgrade? And the agent gave me a reasonable price and I paid it. And I was very happy. I did leave the plane with one of those little Delft blue houses, which are another amazing SkyTeam KLM souvenir. I'm sure that everybody in this community knows about.
Fun little fact. They give those to you on the Fifth Freedom from Singapore to Denpasar.
There you go.
I flew one of the shortest flights for in business class to get those Delft houses.
Yeah. And speaking of those short flights like that, back during COVID, but even now, I've looked at prices like Emirates F on those Fifth Freedoms. I can't remember.
Like the Bangkok, Hong Kong?
Hong Kong. But yeah, I was thinking Hong Kong. Yeah. You can get first class. It's like $600. If you want to just pay for it, it's only a handful of hours.
But you get your shower. You get the shower,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So you get that experience. And then in my head, I'm going like, okay, I'm just testing it out to make sure I want to do it for 16 hours or 200,000 miles or something like that. Is it really worth it? The other thing is, and I kind of regret this because I was, Joburg is actually a good place to pick up low premium economy seats for SkyTeam. And I think the going price right now, I've done it a couple of times, Joburg to any of the three SkyTeam hubs in Europe, Heathrow, Paris, or Amsterdam. So Joburg up to Europe, over to either JFK, that's $1,300, or you can go all the way to LA for $1,700. You make a ton of miles because it's a partner flight and it's based on distance. So you don't buy a Delta ticket, you buy it through the partners. But remember Air France, they used to, they don't do it now, but they had the buy up into from premium economy. And I'd already upgraded using a global certificate from Delta. And the upgrade cost into La Première was only $900 out of Joburg.
What a bargain that would be.
I didn't do it because I'd already confirmed business. I asked how much the coach, I can't remember how much coach was at that point. Doing those paid upgrades, you know, you can either even get La Première, they do it. So it's different depending on the route and everything. So
and that was Joburg all the way to the US or was
no,
it
just Joburg to TDG? It was just to Paris, yeah.
Mm. That makes a little bit more sense. But even then.
Well, I guess the question is do you get the Paris experience as part of La Première or are you still
arriving on La Première, you'd think they'd let you transit in the F Lounge, but you'd probably have to look.
I want to say yeah.
And then in my head, I was going like, okay, do it on the return. That way you get the lounge. So maybe not. I can't remember. But another thing I realized on this trip was because I was in the Middle East for a little bit, you know, Cairo, Beirut, down in that area, using Virgin Miles, they seem to price out distance from point A to point C as the currency or, you know, sort of the award chart. So you can go a very short distance point to point. But if you connect in Paris on a larger plane to where it's like 5 hours Cairo, Paris, or maybe even six, then Cairo to Rome or something like that. Or actually, I think it was like Dubai, Paris, Cairo or something crazy like that. It was only like 9,000 miles in coach and like 18,000 in business on two long haul or, you know, wide bodies.
Wow.
18,000 for 12 hours of flying.
Very miles efficient, it sounds.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was on using Virgin on that. And I just accidentally stumbled on that. I was like, wow, that's a good deal right there. So, but that's different. That's what my big takeaway, I think, was how to do that, those other ways to upgrade your travel on those. So,
I mean, so it sounds like you've become a SkyTeam expert, which is absolutely awesome.
I was a million miler when I was 29 years old.
Okay, so you've been a SkyTeam expert, yeah. But perhaps you've refined those skills a little bit more with the partners.
Yeah. I'll be able to do that a little bit more on with a million miles. So my 15th. So of all the 19 flights that I took, I don't expect like ITA to credit and one other. But then even some of the other ones, I just recently my Korean credited. And that hit my 15 just this morning. So I still
congratulations.
I don't have the million yet, but it officially did credit. So we'll see. So hopefully a lot more SkyTeam coming.
I can't wait to hear more about it. And we'd love to have you back on, especially for a Patreon episode, if you're open to it. Before we close out this topic, I have to ask for our listeners. So this promotion, was it miles or revenue, or did it have to be revenue? And then the second question is roughly how much did you spend either on a per segment or writ large? You know, share what you feel comfortable with. But I just want to give our listeners a perspective because, I mean, you did a significant amount of flying. I mean, 19 carriers, that's 19 segments minimum, not to mention repositioning and all that other stuff. I think it would just be helpful for our listeners to just have a little bit of perspective of kind of what that takes.
Well, going back to could you use miles? Yes, you could, but it had to be SAS miles, so Eurobonus miles. A friend of mine, Marty, actually was the one who pointed this out, but you had to be active or already have some miles in your account or something like that. You could buy miles from SAS and then use them, but hardly anybody ever had either. So it was cash miles mostly. In terms of what I actually used, I kind of gave up on that and actually haven't sat down to calculate it yet. I kept track of the fare basis because that's the important thing to make sure you qualify to actually get points on it. But the way I looked at it is this. 1 million miles divided by 50,000 for a one-way business class to Europe. That's 20 business class flights to Europe. And then if I divide that by the cost of a ticket, let's say it's going to cost me $3,000 total to do it versus $4,000. The difference for each of those redemptions is only $10, $15, $20. But it made a huge difference to take the most convenient routing that was the fastest, best connection to where I could still sleep and work. So I actually didn't really worry about price. If I had to guess, and I'm going to figure it out once I get settled and do everything, but I was probably paying about 150 per second. So,
well, I really like that. I do, because not everything has to be penny pinching, right? I mean, you did 19 airlines. This was something that you wanted to do. This is something that you took vacation time to do. This is something that you got enjoyment out of. And so you don't have to penny pinch. I think that's something that we in the community sometimes miss out on. You know, sometimes you just want to be able to experience. When we travel, we've got a $30 rule. Used to be a $20 rule. Well, inflation. You know,
well, I've heard about this. Hey, you told me about this. Yeah, it makes your life go a lot easier. Yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. You're walking down. You're hungry. Hey, I'm going to duck in for a soda. I'm going to duck in for a baguette. I'm going to, we'll stop for a glass of wine. You know, you're taking it to a level that's appropriate for you. You wanted to do this. You wanted those flights to be efficient. And the reality is even having the efficient flights didn't break your bank, especially when you put into perspective the reward at the end of the end of the rainbow.
Yeah. It was more of an investment of like, am I going to invest $20 or even 10 or 15 even maybe in the future to make my life much better now? Am I willing to pay $20 later and have a much more efficient, because I'm not going to say it was easy. There were times I was just, man, I was so tired.
I can only imagine.
And it was really a mental thing. So I didn't actually buy any of my tickets in advance. If I bought it more than 24 hours in advance, that was rare. I used Priceline's refundability often to where I think I'm going to take this flight. It's within 24 hours. So just book it. And then I take another one. I bought two tickets at the airport, but I was aware of what the prices were for the routing. And a lot of it I used, especially for the Asia stuff, skip lagging. So like, for example, from Guangzhou to Xiamen to Seoul, for whatever reason, to Seoul, as long as you flew to Seoul, it was always cheap from everywhere, you know, within China, within other parts of Asia. Seoul was always cheap. So then I would I think I had four flights back to back to back to back going to Korea, but I only took the first segment because I skip landed, because flying from, say, Xiamen to Shanghai is very expensive. Flights within China are actually very expensive. Hub to hub is very expensive for that. But if you tack on that Korean segment and then just throw it away, you get it cheaper. So a $300 flight is now $100. But I would use the 24-hour Priceline rule, because a lot of times, you know, there was this, you know, plenty of people were scared that, hey, you miss a connection. It's a 4-hour connection, but there's only 3 flights a day. Well, you're not going to make it. And then if you've already purchased non-refundable tickets, then you're kind of messed up with that. So I was like, look, I'm going to pay a little bit more and I'm going to have peace of mind that I can just cancel it, not lose all my money. But really, one of the most difficult parts was I kept looking at Google Flights all the time. Could I find it cheaper? Could I find it cheaper? And then I just quit. I was like, no, don't do it. It's spending too much mental energy
Right. Don't let the
to find, you know, everybody wants to
perfect.
Be that.
Yeah.
The perfect.
Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, right? You know, is the usual saying that I think I've been in the back of my mind as you've been talking for the last couple of minutes. So
absolutely. Yeah.
The guy on Flyer Talk, and I stopped reading that Flyer Talk thread. I just quit after like the 20th page. I don't think I read Flyer Talk.
Because it'll drive you nuts.
After I got to segment two, I just quit. I was like, nope, not going to do it.
You knew your strategy already. That was only going to make you second guess yourself. Yeah. No, so
there's the guy. I'm making up. I don't know who this person is. I don't even know. I'm sure somebody has said, oh, I did it for $1,876.
I mean, good for them.
Good. Yeah, I'm like, cool. I did it for $3,500. Yeah. But you know what? I was able to work. I was able to sleep.
Yes.
I was able to do everything. I had fun at the different lounges, everything. And then, you know, some of the other people I met on the way, man, they were just nonstop, go, 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 go. And I'm like, no.
Doing it in like a week or something, right?
Yeah. Oh, I mentioned this. The guy I met, I think I was in week three. I don't think I mentioned this. One of the people, he was on his 14th segment when I met him. Week three of the promo.
Talk about early adopters. So he was really on the game.
Yeah. So, and he's on Flyer Talk. I have his WhatsApp. I need to message him. But he was done in 3 weeks, you know,
That's crazy.
That was crazy. So
any final thought on this promotion, your experience with the promotion and sort of, you know, would you do it again?
Oh, absolutely. I would have done it if I could have done it, like what I learned of how to do it. I could have easily done it quickly and conveniently in about 2 weeks. So if I could have like stacked it on, I would have done it over and over and over. It could have been so easy knowing what I know now.
But I'd be tempted if something comes back around one of these days. I got lots of people to ask, to ask advice about, because, you know, it is just amazing how many people are SAS points millionaires now, or will soon be. A lot more than I thought of, that I thought would, because, you know, and it's funny, just finding the people that they're all on this one Kenyan Airways flight. And it's like, oh, it's a little meetup that kind of wasn't planned. Anyway.
And SAS, I thought, had something. I don't know if it was just a random social media post or if it was one of their, you know, higher ups just commenting, saying that they were actually surprised at how many people had set out on this challenge. So, I mean, I think it's great because it's an airline that we didn't, like, as a Star Alliance airline, I saw them once in a blue moon as being a viable word.
If somebody in Copenhagen was like, Sven, that was a great marketing idea. You know, we have to spend all this money on million points on everything. Let's not ask Sven next time for the next, you know, marketing plan, you know. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm being a little bit funny, but...
I was laughing on mute. Yes, Sven either got the Employee of the Year award or the exact opposite of that.
Exactly.
Won't be hired anywhere ever again.
So I think we had one other topic that you wanted to talk about. And I know it's a topic that's close to your heart, and it's a topic that's close to a lot of our hearts. Tom had the chance to speak at the event this past year. I haven't made it myself just because it's always around my birthday, and I have a thing about traveling someplace that I haven't been or someplace far and wide for my birthday. But you sort of helped to reinvigorate the Chicago seminars some years ago.
Yeah, after COVID, a good friend of mine, Howie Rappaport, had been running Chicago seminars, and, you know, COVID kind of took that away from us. But afterwards, and just, it had been at the Holiday Inn in Elk Grove Village for 13 years. And after a hotel hasn't gone through a renovation, and, you know, everybody's a Hyatt fan or Hilton or Marriott. It's just, but the thing was about that event. And I was like, man, the first time I went was maybe the sixth year or something. I was in grad school, so didn't travel a lot. But when I finished grad school, got back into the game, and Howie's like, hey, you want to come by? I was like, yeah, sure. It's like, where is it? It's like the Holiday Inn. And I'm like, oh, maybe not. But I literally...
I'm not going to lie. That's a reason I didn't want to... That was definitely a blocker for me.
Yeah. But I 100% true. So I've actually managed a couple other events, conferences for work. for both professionally and personally with other events. So I know what to look for, but I literally walked into the Holiday Inn and was like, oh, do not move it. Do not move it. This is a great location. Great. It's just set up win-win situation. And, you know, this was well before COVID. And because we had the whole hotel, everybody got to know each other, the community building, it was perfect, except it was at a Holiday Inn and the rooms were small, hadn't been. So anyway, COVID comes around and we finally hope and ends, you know, not ends, but we get to have another one. And it's a Holiday Inn. Everybody's such a Hyatt fan and the hotel was getting run around. We were able to work out a really good deal with the Hyatt Regency O'Hare, which is a huge hotel. 1,100 rooms. It is massive. We're able to move Chicago Seminars, the oldest and largest Points and Miles event in the world. Had over 500 people there, about 55 speakers over the event, something from beginners to advanced people. And obviously, you two have been around the game. A lot of it is knowing other people. So two ways I look at it is, even though this is a large event that, you know, there's entry level to advanced, but when you meet people, but also get to know the advanced people off outside the event, that's really where it starts to shine. But I also look at it like, okay, people like us, we've been around the game for long enough. It's time for us to get back. So we're the older generation. We've done things. It's time for us to share. So even though it's a large event, you don't have to share the super secret sauce. But you can go help all these beginners to get and take advantage and learn the things about, you know, that you did, that you're grateful for over, for all three of us, you know, we're looking at decades here. But yeah, seminars, you know, a completely volunteer event, nobody gets paid, speakers don't even get paid, the organizers definitely don't get paid, you know, there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears on it. We're trying to set up the dates and the location again. But yeah, chicagoseminars.org. It's a great place, an event to go through. Hope
you know, having been there, this last one, it was a great success, Chris. It was amazing. Definitely one of the best ones ever. The location was amazing. Again, I think your experience, you know, putting together meetings, I think definitely contributed. All the things you said, you know, all the interaction, the social interaction, all the meetings and contacts and everything that was exchanged was great. And the venue was amazing. And you know, I think the fact that, you know, you could see that money had gone into the event and that's where all the kind of the fees and everything, because you could just, you know, the quality of the food and the, you know, the venue and kind of how everything got put together. Really excellent, amazing place. And I cannot give a strong enough recommendation to listeners that when and if those, you know, when those tickets go out for the next Chicago seminars, make it a point to block it on your calendar and buy those tickets, because it's a great opportunity.
And I think it really aligns with the ethos of the community. So most of my experience with the bigger conferences were FTUs. I know Chicago Seminars has always been separate from the FTUs. Even at the frequent traveler universities, back when they were big, big events, we took over hotels down in Tampa, in Tyson's and other places. Charity was always a big deal there, and as well as obviously the networking and everything else. And you guys keep that alive in the Chicago seminars as well. I mean, we have incredible experiences. I mean, I would wager a guess that everybody on this particular podcast episode has been to the Maldives. You know, we've been to places that people probably would never have dreamed that they'd be able to go. We've flown in products that people probably don't even know exist in some parts of the, well, definitely in some parts of the world, but even some parts of the country. You know, the fact that we can still carve out a little bit of our wallets to support important, you know, charitable causes, I think is really important. And I love how you guys have kept that alive, even when, you know, as kind of FTU, and this is not a shade toward FTU. Tom and I are really excited to participate with FTU in May. They've got an event coming up that we've been asked to port, and we're excited for that. And I think they're trying to go bigger. I don't know how bigger they're going to be able to go. We're anxious to hear about that. Others have had, you know, gotten smaller and smaller. And as you get smaller, you lose a little bit of that charitable aspect. And I love that you guys have just kept that going. It's the camaraderie. It's the networking. it's helping those that are new to the community, but it's also the charity as well. And I think all those things come together to make a really, truly unique event.
Yeah, and just to plug that a little bit more, that's mainly from our raffle, but also our auction. So a lot of our speakers, we auction off our speakers, but we raised, don't quote me on this, I want to say it was close to $30,000. For 500 people, that's a significant amount that went to two different charities. And we are a 501c3, so again, purely volunteer effort. Nonprofit, but the charity aspect of it, and just it's a community event. We're trying to structure it to where even like all of our presentations, we want to open it up to be, even if you're not a blogger, if you're an expert in something, throw in a proposal, we'll look at it, and then you're going to be speaking in front of 500 people. So we're trying to really push the, there were others very intentional social aspects where people could meet people, like we grouped, hey, you're from the Northeast, go over here. You're from the West Coast, go over here, meet those people. There's other smaller groups, meetups going on. So trying to make that happen. So a lot of things going on, but I appreciate you mentioned the charity aspect of it, because that is big, big, huge. And that, you know, 30 grand is not chump change for an event just come together for 48 hours. So that's pretty significant.
And with the amount of volunteers that give their time,
and your volunteers, time. Especially at the, you know, there's the organizer level. There's about six or seven key people, but then there's 20 or 30 more below that at the event level that really don't, you know, they've been there, they've done that. They're like, where else can I help out? Because we want newer people to always be at the event and learning. So, you know, registration, other stuff coming up, prepping for the next event that's going on, or a social or something like that. It does take a lot of people at the actual event. So we're very appreciative of that.
A lot of unsung heroes at that seminars. So
yeah, unsung heroes, and it takes a village. Okay. Well, we've been going a whole lot longer than I think any of us expected to go.
I wasn't surprised. I figured this was going to be a long episode.
I figured it'd be long. I didn't think it would get close to our longest, which I think we're on the heels of. Any final thoughts, Chris, before we before we close out?
No, just enjoy travel while you can.
And Chris,
miles and devaluations. They come and go. When I hear the youngsters talking about, oh, devaluation is, I'm like, yeah, but
they have no idea.
You can earn a lot more. Like, I've been around since 19. My first points flight was 1989.
Oh, you got me beat.
You got me beat as well.
It was American. Melbourne, Florida to Orlando to DFW to LA to Honolulu to Sydney to.
That's a good one. That's a pretty round trip. That sounds like a pretty amazing one. We might need to hear about that next time.
Yeah, you beat me on my first, and I was many years later. That is incredible.
You know, back then it was always difficult to earn miles. You had to fly it.
You had to actually fly.
Yeah, but then, you know, first, so I always use this one, like first class or coach to the Caribbean or Mexico was 20K round trip. First class was only 25. I mean, it was barely, but getting those 25 was difficult. And they're like, devaluations. I'm like, yeah, but you can just sign for a credit card and you get three flights. It's
well, and that's a really great point. I mean, you think about it, 15, 20, let's call it 20 years ago, you had the gold coins, right? And we don't talk a ton of manufacturer spending on this show because it's, you know, on the free side, you know, the no annual fee side on the Milanomics feed. But you're talking about 1-to-1 on the gold, right? Cut forward to what, 5 or 7 years ahead, and you're talking about 5 points per dollar on inks at Staples and Office Depot. And, you know, so you've got just an absolute, you've got a great point. And that's an easy example. I mean, there are even sign up bonuses where
back in that day, you know, like 10K or 20K, I was like, oh, 10,000 miles. Wow. You know, for signing up for a credit card, what a great deal. You
know? And then you've got when the American Airlines executive card first came out, it was 100,000 points after 7,000 spend. And then you could churn them based on Citi's rules. That was
golden. I feel like it's almost like the golden age.
It felt like it, but then you look at some of the things that they did in the last year with American Express. I mean,
you know, the one thing that will never devalue, the wonderful friendship and camaraderie of this community. That is the one thing that only increases in value, guys. So I'd focus on that because that's the one thing you don't have to worry about, you know, devaluations. I think these connections and friendships you make, they last a very long time and they're very durable and extraordinarily valuable.
So well said. Chris, can our listeners find you anywhere?
I'm not really on social media that much. So
they can find you at on Chicago a Sky Seminars.
Team, on a SkyTeam flight, a I Sky guess.
SkyTeam flight or at ChicagoSeminars.org.
Delta One Lounge. You know, you'll be there next time you're there.
Well, that's the show. Thanks for joining us.
If you've enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a Milenomics Patreon member and get access to even more in-depth miles, points, and travel content.
Until then, we hope your next story is a travel story.